Hello, and welcome to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, where authors from around the world share how they hope to inspire fellow writers and readers to believe in themselves and others every Tuesday at 1 p.m. on KVSH 101.9 FM and every day at marchtwisdale.com as a podcast. I'm your host, March Twisdale, and I thank you for joining us today. Hey, Garth, how are you today?
I'm very good, March. How are you?
I'm great. I've just been looking forward to this interview, well, ever since you agreed to do it. Alrighty, so let's see here. My audience may or may not have been around for your earlier interview a few years back. So why don't you ground yourself for the folks that are listening and tell them who you are, what you do.
Okay, my name is Garth Stein. I'm a Seattleite. I grew up here, up in Shoreline. I went to Shorewood High School, go Thunderbirds, and then went to New York for a long time to try my ways there. Ended up meeting my wonderful wife and having a couple of kids there, and then we moved back to Seattle in 2001, and I've been here in the literary community writing books ever since. If anybody knows a book I've written, it would probably be The Art of Racing in the Rain, which was my third novel. Came out a long time ago in 2008, and it's a book that is narrated by a dog who tells the story of his family's life. And at the time I wrote it, it was a little bit controversial, I have to say. I sent it to my agent in New York, and he promptly told me no one will read a book narrated by a dog. So I fired him. And found a new agent and who believed in me, and that book went on to live for over 3 years on the New York Times bestseller list, proving that people will read a book narrated by a dog.
Yeah.
And so it became very successful. I wrote a novel after that, A Sudden Light, my follow-up, and I'm working on a new novel now. But in the meantime, I've been spending my creative energies working on a graphic novel in a three-part series called The Cloven. And the first book came out last summer, and we're working hard on the second installment, and the third will be coming up in a couple of years, I guess, for the third one.
Right.
I don't know.
Right. Well, okay, yes. So I am this year and probably next year, I've decided to have a 100% focus on fiction. You know, in the past, it was always I leaned a little heavy towards nonfiction, which is fine, but what's been really interesting about this decision that I made is that I also realized that when I did touch on fiction before, it was usually within a certain, similar genre. And now I'm finding, I've got an author, Jessica Brody, who's going to join me in about a month with a middle grade book. And then you have this graphic novel, which I will admit, I don't think I've ever read a graphic novel before.
Well, that's an interesting observation, and many people don't feel that they have, and yet maybe they have. You know, graphic novel is almost a faux genre. You know, I mean, they're comic books, but it's a long form comic book. It's not like a floppy like we used to get back in the day. You know, you go to the 7-Eleven and buy your Superman for 25 cents.
Right. I did read those, Casper the Ghost.
Sure.
And things like that, yes. But they feel different.
It is. It's very different. And then, you know, at a certain point, there was a genre, you know, people started trying out their ways, their art form in longer form. And I believe if you wanted to go into the history of it, someone may disagree with this, but, you know, the phrase graphic novel, I believe, was coined for Art Spiegelman, whose book series, Maus, M-A-U-S, was very significant and important, and it was about Nazis, the graphic novel about Nazis. And Nazis in this graphic novel are rats, and the Jews are mice, and there's a whole thing, and it's this whole metaphorical play on the Holocaust as a cartoon. And when they were publishing it, the publishers didn't know how to get across to people that this isn't, there's no Man of Steel in this, there's no light of a bat that shines on a cloud. This is serious stuff, but it's being told with a visual form that really lends itself, it brings a lot, you know, the visual aspect of it brings a lot to the text. And so somebody said, that's not a comic book, it's a graphic novel. And there have been some that have been really popular over the years. Persepolis was one, very big a few years ago. There's one called Epileptic that was really quite powerful.
Oh, I hear about them. I hear about them sometimes. It's just not, and I actually am going to have to ask you to help me a little, because, you know, I've got a wide age range when it comes to people who will walk up to me and start chatting at me about the show. So I feel like I'm a little, not old to be reading a graphic novel. That's not what I'm trying to say. I feel like I'm underskilled because of my age demographic. There were a couple of pages where I'm sitting there going, oh no, wait, am I supposed to read left to right, up to down, and then move over? Or do I go, and one of them, you go straight across left to right, both pages, I'm almost certain. But I'm sitting here trying to figure it out. And I was laughing. It was one of those things like when you're on the computer and your 13-year-old just rolls their eyes and goes boom, boom, boom. And they're like that, Mom. You know?
Right. Well, it is true that, people who are native, like anything else, people who are native to it just get it a little bit quicker and easier. It's the same thing. You may notice that your children with an iPad are way more adept at it than your parents, for instance, because it's just not intuitive to someone who's never who's already been doing things for 50 or 60 years. Whereas a 3-year-old can pick up an iPad and just start touching it, and it makes it work. Right?
Because they have no other pre-knowledge to block the intel they're taking in, and they just sort of flow with it faster, I think.
Right. They have fewer boundaries, fewer preconceptions, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So they're just going to try to figure it out.
Yeah. Well, okay, so...
There is that aspect of it, but, you know, the idea of what you're saying about the visual, you know, how do you read a comic book page, that's something that, I had to learn, because I write traditional novels. I write the old school, words on paper. And to work with an illustrator, Matt Southworth, who's my partner and illustrator, has been fabulous, because he's had to kind of teach me about how we read and how we look at things visually, how we use pictures to tell a narrative story. And I think that's really kind of a cool thing to mess with and to work with. Right. And I did this once before. Years ago, I did a presentation with a pretty famous now, then he wasn't as famous, sculptor in the Seattle area, Preston Singletary. He's a Tlingit artist. He has basically, I'm a Tlingit descendant as well, Tlingit Indians from southeastern Alaska. But Preston has come up with a new method of working, using traditional Tlingit totems, but using glass to show them as opposed to wood. And it's got a whole new look on this sort of thing. And he and I did a presentation on the narrative aspects of visual art versus the visual aspects of narrative art. And it was really quite interesting. And there's a big crossover when you start, working with it. You see, it's not like, oh, there's, we have bucket one. Take a ball from bucket one and a ball from bucket two, and then you have it. No. All the balls are mixed up in one giant, bathtub, and so it's a much more organic and graceful way of working than one might suspect.
It's gorgeous. It's both pages make the one photo. This is not the fold-out, which is four pages. This is just two. It's early on. It's after he's just escaped. We'll get into the thing later. And at the top, you've got this gorgeous red, and there's these three images of him racing left to right.
Right.
And then on the left, I love this, you've got this purple, it's an image of him with the leaves are in black. It's almost like he's actually the void rather than the object.
Yeah. No, that's a great question and discussion point. I think that for me, it would be helpful to understand the origins of the story itself. So at some point many years ago, I was having lunch with another writer friend of mine, and we were kind of goofing on Twilight. Right.
You mean Twilight by Stephanie Meyer?
Yes, of course, because it was like, Twilight 8 was out or something.
Right.
And it just sold more books. In the first week it sells, 100 million books, and everyone else is walking around with a box in the back of their car saying, would anybody please take one of my books for free?
I sold 11 books. Yay.
And I said to her, to this friend of mine, I was like, what do you think is going to be the next? Because vampires are clearly done. What's next?
Right.
And we're like bouncing off each other. And then we kind of came up with this idea of what if there were like these weird mutants and they were kind of goat people and they were really fast, but they could hide their feet so no one could tell. So they could kind of blend, but they kind of couldn't, you know, kind of like at the end of the what's the cartoon? Not, I was going to say The Impossibles, but it's the family cartoon with the little kid Dash who's like super fast.
Oh, The Incredibles.
You know, The Incredibles, right. He has to, like, blend. He has to act like he's a normal kid and not run too fast. So
right.
We thought, oh, that'd be funny. So then I started to write it as a short story for a literary series event that I was doing at Hugo House in Seattle.
Mm.
And it kind of was this fun, kind of dark story about GMOs gone crazy. Now, this was before CRISPR was in the news and all that kind of stuff, all this mm-hmm. DNA stuff that people can do. And I was like, what if you took that to an extreme and just, like, try to invent, like, designer people with different elements of different animals and so forth? Like, and so it became this story. And it was pretty successful. I did it at a literary series, read it at the group. Everyone loved it. And I thought, I think there's enough in there to make a novel out of it. And so I started to write it as a novel, and I finished a draft of it, and I gave it to my wife to read. She's my first reader always. And
That's
she read
awesome.
It, and she said, no. She said, no, this is not your next book. And I was like, well, why not? And she's like, I just don't get it. She's like, I don't even get how their legs work. You know, they have different, you know, they have different leg joints. You know, they're not like human legs. And I was like, oh, I guess I didn't really visualize them too much. And she said, yeah, you need to visualize them more. And I was like, well, image that you could see in like a comic book. And she's like, well, I'd probably buy it then. So I started to work. I called up a friend of mine who's the publisher of Fantagraphics. And I said, how do I do this? And he said, you know what? We talked for quite a bit. And then he said, you know, you should meet this guy I know. He's an illustrator, and I think you guys would like each other. And so he introduced me to Matthew Southworth, who has done, he did Stumptown, the comic book series Stumptown, which was made into a TV show on ABC. I think it got canceled last year.
But he remained involved with it when it moved to television, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He did.
Yeah.
And so he and I said, Matt, what do I do? I want to tell this as a comic book. And he's like, he read the whole script, the whole book, and he's like, well, this thing, we talked back and forth. And so what we arrived at was this. This is what our process is.
Mm-hmm.
I write a script, like a screenplay, but it's for a graphic novel. So what does that mean? It means I don't really have to worry about cameras or any of that nonsense. I need to worry about what's going on in the scene, but write it as a scene with dialogue and the whole deal. And I deliberately overwrite it because I mm-hmm. know that when you go to the actual graphic novel page, we're going to strip all of the words out of it because it's about the images.
Mm-hmm.
But I need to give Matt the words that are in my head so that he knows what to draw.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets the script, he reads through the script, and then he breaks it down and into scenes and says, I think this is this, and I think this is this, and here's what I think is important in this scene, and here's what's important in that scene. And this is why he has to say that, because as you said a minute ago, when you turn a page and open up a page in a book, your eye, if it's a graphic novel, your eyes go somewhere. And it's up to the author and the illustrator to suggest with great enthusiasm the proper way to read the page. Do you read left page first, then right page? Do you read the whole page at once? Do you read all the way across both pages on the top and then go back and then go all the way across in the next line, etc.? And so this is really important when you turn in terms of developing the story, because even though you may start in the upper left-hand corner, you can still see out of the corner of your eye the lower right-hand corner. So you're getting a little bit of a hint, even though you're kind of trained to start in a certain way by our culture. Right,
right.
So I had to learn all this kind of stuff and understand how that... So what happens is I give Matt the script, he goes through it and starts to break it down into two-page chunks, two-page openings, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
I think this would be here, and I think this would be here. And then he gives that breakdown with just stick figures, maybe.
Right.
He gives that to me, and I look at it, and I say, well, that's all good, well and good, Matt, but you just spent, like, a page and a half on this one moment, and when I wrote that, I really only intended it to be, like, a quarter of a page. That's not supposed to be a big moment. So you've given too much weight to it. So I want to take all the weight out of that and I want you to put weight on this other thing. And then so we negotiate that. That's our collab. That's the first step of our collaboration, right, is both of us understanding what we're trying to deliver on this page spread, right? Mm-hmm. So once we both agree what we're trying to do, then he can go in and start to flesh it out and say, here's what I think the mood should feel like, and here's what I think, you know, there are some scenes that are at night where the only light is coming from a barrel fire underneath, you know, the freeway down in I-5, for instance.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to glow in this kind of eerie way. And, you know, we can only see what's within the pool of light. We can't see what's beyond. So we start working on moods. And then we have to go through it again for time. In this first book, there's a lot of backstory that takes place in the 1990s, oddly enough, on Vashon Island. And it's a whole time change between, like, segments. And so we had to have a way to visually show that, and we used color palettes to do that.
Oh.
So there'll be big color shifts from present to past that you may not even notice.
I didn't. I totally didn't catch it. It was the story itself where I would scratch my head and go, wait a minute, that's the guy, and he's letting the kids out of the truck. They're small, but now there's like all these cloven that are really big. Oh,
right.
That was the moment where I went, oh, they're bouncing around in time.
Yeah, right.
Sorry, I'm a little slow.
No,
it's
no,
been an adventure reading the book.
Well, it's part of it, you know, hopefully the color gives you an indication that something is different. So there are ways to do it. So we go through like that, and then we get to the point where we both agree on say, how the story is going to be laid out. And then Matt gets to work doing the ink first. He does everything in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I discuss. And then when we set that, then I do the words. So then we do an overlay using tracing paper on his black and whites.
Mm-hmm.
And I start to rough out the dialogue that is now going to be on the page. See, because the dialogue that I've written is too much, usually.
Right.
So I have to strip it down, and sometimes I don't need any dialogue at all. You mentioned that on that spread that you were talking about.
Yeah.
At some point, we were stripping out so many words that we got to that spread to do the color, and I said, you know what, Matt? I think the art tells the whole story. I don't think we need any words at all.
Mm-hmm.
And he laughed, and he said, you know, Garth, I usually agree with you, but I think we do need some words on this page. So sometimes I'm more willing to give up words than he is.
Right. Well, so it's been hard for me when I've glanced at them. My kids would like just, you know, shovel them down like a bowl of ice cream. But this book is pretty darn close to a little bit smaller than a magazine size. And I think I've really appreciated your decision to go with this size.
Yeah. For sure. I mean, and when you consider that the Matt works on basically, you know, desk-sized piece of paper, there's a lot of information in there, and it is important to make sure. You know, there are some pieces that can be told much more simply. I'm trying to think. I did an interview with a guy who is from Australia. I'm trying to find his book here on my bookshelf. His are much more kind of woodblockish, you know, fewer details in the
mm-hmm.
shadows and so forth. And so that kind of a book can absolutely be sort of squeezed down, you know, compressed a little bit because you're not, the visuals and the details are not as important necessarily.
Right, but here you guys really weighted the visuals a lot as giving them responsibility for telling the story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and we working with Fantagraphics, our publisher, we all agreed on this. I mean, I think Matt wanted to go to a bigger format than what we have, but that was voted down.
This is brilliant. Bigger would have made it more like a coffee table book or something, and I think less people can find a place for that in their physical lives. This is going to fit on your bookshelf, no problem. The colors are, I love the colors. They're, what is it? Basically, there's a slight mutedness to every single color you use. So even though they're super bright, there's nothing that's like fluorescent or something. There's something soft about them. Am I reading that right, or is that just my impression?
You are absolutely reading that right. Very good reading, Mark.
Uh-huh.
In fact, because Matt wanted it to have a look of, we didn't want it to look, when we said, what do we want the look of this thing to be? We didn't want it to feel high tech. We wanted it, because the Cloven are not high tech. So understand this, the idea of the Cloven, the story, and this is why talking about all this form is fun, but if you kind of don't know the context of the story, it makes it a little bit maybe disembodied.
No, I was going to say, I was going to dive into that next. So go ahead. Do you want to actually do that? So let's tell people what the book's about.
Yeah, it's the story of a young man, Tuck is his nickname. James Tucker is his name. And he's basically trying to find his identity. So it's a universal story, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's got a monster aspect to it. So it's a universal Frankenstein story. Okay, but here's the setup of it. Back in the early 90s, when things first started to come to light about, how we could modify the human genome, there were rules put in place. And this was, back in the days of, Bill Clinton, I guess, was president when we were going through. No, yeah, I guess it was.
Yeah. Remember we had WTO in Seattle, and Bill Clinton came and spoke, I think, on the tarmac about how, well, GMOs are great, wonderful, going to save the world. And then there was all the protests around that. So, that was definitely a hot moment when it came to the discussion of do we not, and what will happen.
Right. And so at that time, the U.S. government pledged to, they didn't outlaw experimentation with the human genome. Mm-hmm. So you can experiment with animals all you want, anywhere you want. But the human is a little bit different. People start getting a little freaked out about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so 33 countries right now have a moratorium against scientific experimentation with the human genome. The United States is not one of those countries. It's legal to do it here, but the government won't fund it. And the other thing is there's no way to get stem cells. In order to do this sort of experimentation, you need stem cells. And so they put a moratorium on stem cells. And so only an initial round of stem cells were allowed to be used.
I remember that being talked about, the whole question about stem cells and everything.
Right. So you can't do it. Now, that doesn't mean people aren't doing it, because if you're extremely wealthy and can fund it yourself, you can do whatever you want. And as you know, in the Northwest, we have many, many quirky billionaires who are happy to experiment on all sorts of weird stuff, right?
Hey, don't isolate the Pacific Northwest. We've got quirky billionaires everywhere.
You're right. And in fact, there's a quirky billionaire in California who's doing experimentation today on the Chimera project, which is this idea of merging human stem cells with cells of a pig and growing human organs inside of a pig's body.
Right. I think that's always been the idea. Like, they had those mice that came out of China that had, ears growing out of their backs and things like that.
Exactly.
So it was, the idea was, we'll make life better for humans.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's a great idea.
It is
idea. One billionaire, a particular billionaire in my story in Seattle, says, that's a brilliant idea. We're going to save the world. We're not going to, because there's going to be too many people and not enough food in 20 years. Instead of growing more food, why don't we just make the human body more efficient at digesting food? So if we could merge the human body, the human digestive system, with the digestive system of a ruminant, like, say, a goat, they could eat a lot more different kinds of foods.
Oh, yeah.
We can't eat leaves because we don't have enough stomachs to digest them.
Right.
But a goat does. So he begins an experiment on a private lab that he has financed on Vashon Island, and they start working on making a human-goat hybrid. And it works.
That would be Dr. Kenneth Langer.
Yes.
Is the fictional
character.
He's
the genius behind it.
Now, that's the genius guy who loses Tuck later, kiddo.
That's right.
It's not, what's the name of the billionaire who funds it?
His name is Barry Goff.
Goff, that's what it was. Right.
I
love this. I have to say, because everyone out there who's listening who lives here on Vashon, just so you guys know, I mean, Garth did a really good job of sort of nailing us down in little tiny ways. And I love on this first page where it starts to go into this period of the time in the story, right?
Yeah.
At the very bottom, it's called Airy Farms. It says no trespassing solicitations, fresh eggs.
Right.
And I crack up every time I see that. No fresh eggs.
Yes.
And I'm like, does that mean they don't want me to give them my fresh eggs or that they don't sell, they won't offer them to me or both.
Well, I guess you'd have to really be a Vashon Islander in order to know this.
Well, I'm a Vashon Islander, and I don't know. But this island right now, last year, everyone got chickens. They were all worried we were going to, like, run out of food for the pandemic. Yeah. We are swimming in the most delicious chicken eggs on this island right now. No one needs them because they all have their own chickens. It's hilarious.
Oh, that's great.
Okay,
that's
great. So yes, so you're delving into this deep subject.
It begins. He finances this lab. It works, but they can't get the feet out of the equation. They can't get the hoofs out. They can make a person with a digestive tract of a ruminant, but they have hoofs and they have really hard foreheads. Mm-hmm. But they could kind of pass if they're good. You know, they could put kind of boots on them maybe and kind of like make them walk a little bit funny. But they can pass as a human because they're pretty much human in every other aspect.
But they do eat. They do eat like a goat.
They do eat like a goat. Yeah.
Okay. Got it.
So it goes on. This is going on in the 90s in this laboratory, and finally it gets mothballed. No one's sure why, but suddenly everyone's, all the scientists are told just to pack up and go home. Mm-hmm. And so our hero, Dr. Kenneth Langner, says this is very dispiriting for him, and he realizes they are planning on euthanizing all these experiments. There are a bunch of little mutant children running around in this laboratory with goat hoofs. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be euthanized. And so rather than that happen, he steals them away, and he takes them into the Cascade Mountains, and he lets them go. Mm-hmm. And he says, I can't help you any more than this. And they're set free, and they go into the mountains, and they propagate, mm-hmm. and they thrive. And some of them stay in the mountains. Some of them move back toward the city. They move back into city living, and they hide in Seattle, where any marginalized population might hide in Seattle, mm-hmm. in the jungle, mm-hmm. in that weird area underneath I-5 where thousands of homeless people have lived and are still living. Because here in Seattle, we have a law saying that public camping on city property is legal, mm-hmm. because we're trying to be very progressive and very, very open-minded to people who don't seem to have a house. So rather than build housing,
we're trying to avoid actually resolving the issue.
And everybody walks by the jungle and they avert their eyes because they don't want to see, you know, what's going on in there. And that's the perfect place for a band of cloven to blend in and hide, and no one bothers them, and they do their business, and no one seems to care. And so that's the setup of the cloven.
Well, I really appreciate you touching upon the homelessness issue, because this is one of the things that I actually, you know, always mention at the beginning of the show, which is that fiction provides us an opportunity to have conversations that may be a little bit too hard to have in just, you know, a really upfront way, because we're all defensive or we're scared or we're anxious. And then you just place that real world issue into a fictional world, and it softens things enough that people can start to think about it. And then hopefully they can pull, if their hearts are changed, if they really gain the empathy or whatever, hopefully they can pull that back into the real world and we see change.
Absolutely right. You've got it spot on. And I believe that's about all literature, and probably all art if we were to really examine it.
Right.
But the idea that, you know, literature is that last refuge for us to be able to agree to disagree.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's no more civil discourse in our society. Everybody just yells at you. I believe this. I believe everybody should be vaccinated. And then I get yelled at by everyone who says, no, nobody should be vaccinated. Mm-hmm. I believe there's too much of this. And it's always fighting. Everyone's always fighting. Mm-hmm. Like it's a knee-jerk reaction. Whatever you believe, I believe 180 degrees the opposite.
Yeah.
But with a book, I can give the same book to two disagreeing people, have them read it, and they could have a totally civil conversation about the topics that are in that book, not realizing how pertinent necessarily they are to their own lives, right?
Right, right. Absolutely.
So that's kind of why I thought this is the perfect way to tell this story, using the medium of, you can read The Cloven as a comic book. It's an adventure story. It's about a guy who's a mutant who's trying to escape pursuers, who's trying to find himself, trying to find his place in the world, trying to find his people. But he's always being pursued by some demon. Somebody's always trying to get him and make him do something else.
Well,
that's a universal story.
And it's his story, Yes, but you did that really good job of what. People who read know what they like, and people who write have to know what readers like so they can give them what they like. And what we all like is we want all of the characters to have a sense of authenticity and to have actual true stakes going on. You can't have like someone who's just, black and white bad guy, and there's no reason why he's a bad guy. He's just a bad guy. I mean, the best thing about a bad guy is when you suddenly learn the backstory, or you notice that they themselves appear to be a little bit insecure about their badness, right? I mean, they need to be relatable. So, what I think you nailed down in a book that probably has less words than the first chapter of most novels, I would say the first half of the first chapter of most novels, there's like very few words in here. Really, this is not a book that deals with a lot of stuff because you have big, giant blocks of script in there. But still, oh my gosh, you've got the. I'm not gonna spoil it for anybody, but
You
let's
can
just
spoil
say, no, you got the mom, and there's a lot of stuff going on with that mom character. And then
it.
you've got, I'm like sitting here going, okay, I want to know when the little girl is gonna come back into the next story, because I'm sure she will.
Oh, yes, she
So,
will.
right, and so I'm just sitting here going, oh my gosh, this is deep and rich. And you know what? Flash fiction exists for the same reason. You don't have to have, 90,000 words always to tell a brilliant story.
Well, that's interesting that you would say that. I think that's absolutely true, and I think that it is a real delineation between, shall we say, short form and long form fiction. And I believe that I would put graphic novels, even though some of them may be quite long, into the short form category. Because when you're writing a short story, part of what you're doing is dealing is you're working with you're depending on working with paradigms. And with what's that other word? Iconic characters, that when,
Archetypes.
archetypes, yes. So that when you have the guy walking into the room with the black cowboy hat on, because you're steeped in our culture, you say, oh, clearly bad guy, obviously. And then when it turns out he's the good guy, you could say, oh, they sure fooled me. Well, it wasn't that hard to fool you, no offense, because you went. But in short form, we make decisions. If you look at, because everyone's talking about Hemingway because of the Burns documentary that just was on,
Right,
and if
right. Everyone I know watched that.
Right. And so it's like, look, I'm an English major. I write books. I've read pretty much every Hemingway novel out there. I am not steeped in his short stories. So I was rather intrigued by all the short story references. So I started reading some of his early short stories and not realizing how bloody short they were. I mean, you talk about someone who's working with archetypes. I mean, he just like, boom, there you go. He in one in a half a, in one of in one Hemingway sentence, everything you need to know about that character. Because that's what we do. We bring that to it. So part of the fun of being a writer is anticipating what the reader is going to bring to the story that you can use to leverage your story in the direction you want it to go into.
I feel I the way I think about it is, and I feel like I'm working with my reader. Sometimes there's a sense of you're creating for your reader. But if you're creating for your reader, then there's really a big separation between you and them, and you're looking at them as just receiver. And I feel like I'm working with my reader, which I think is sort of what you're saying. It's like I'm anticipating, I don't have to say this ad nauseum because I know you're going to bring all this because that's what you want to do. You're looking to solve the problem. You want to find the clues. You're an active participant. And once I shifted into that, it really changed how I really literally feel like I am walking step in step with my future readers when I'm creating a scene. It's like I don't feel like I have to just give it all to them. They're going to show up as well.
That's right. Absolutely. Your readers are predictive. I mean, they're very smart, and they're trying to figure out the puzzle. you're giving them a puzzle and you're holding back some pieces, and they're trying to put the puzzle together as best they can. And that can, you can use that to your advantage in terms of making them look one way, and then, you know, you slip something in the other direction and they're like, whoa, that was a surprise. So yes, absolutely, you're working with your readers' expectations and their preconceptions, and you know, the way you set up the story. It's so about something, they're going to have some thought about that. What are their thoughts about this?
So let me ask you the question then. When you two were collaborating on this story, what was it that you felt that maybe local readers specifically, let's say the ones who were really going to understand some of the references and whatnot, what is it that you might have thought they were going to bring to their experience?
Well, I think that it's interesting, when I started writing it, it was long enough ago, it was like the pre-Trump era, so the kind of the new cynicism that we've developed toward pretty much any news source didn't really exist in the early teens. Mm-hmm. You know, 2011, 2010, 2012 was less cynical, I believe, about...
It's all comparative. It's like cynicism, I think, has been growing for sure. But you're right. I think cynicism is on a big, giant high right now.
Yeah, and I think that we really don't trust a lot of news sources. And I wanted to play with that, for instance. I wanted to definitely have... There's a whole scene in the book where...
Right, you've got, what is it, Cairo or Como?
I think we did Como. I think we did Cairo, and I got yelled at by Como. We did Cairo. We put Cairo on there, and then we did an interview. Matt and I did an interview for the program on Como, and they're like, "Why did you put Cairo on there instead of?"
Oh no! You're like,
how much self interest you guys got? but the idea that I can show you something, I can show you what really happened. I can show you footage of it. I could put you in the scene. There's a scene. What happens with these cloven is that they blend, they hide, they're always contained, they're always worried. In a very real sense, they're very much like, it could be a metaphor for almost any number of marginalized populations that we have.
Right.
You know, let's say a trans teenager. How do you present? How do you tell your story? How do you tell your narrative? You feel very vulnerable about that. So that's how these cloven feel, and yet they do need to express themselves sometimes, and so they go off on these, in the middle of the night, they'll go sort of wilding through parks, sometimes even in downtown Seattle, just to be themselves, just to be free for a minute, you know?
Which is brilliant, because Seattle, it has been a hotspot of parkour for a very long time. I was like, yes, he's bringing the parkour people to the story, yay!
Yeah, the parkour thing, because they're goat people. They're really good at parkour.
They sure are.
Wait till you get to book four, when we realize that the original cloven were actually invented in France.
Well, that's where parkour was invented.
Exactly. and the nickname that they have for them in France is chèvre.
Oh my gosh, great chef, the cheese.
Yes, this is going to be great.
So, oh my God, it's so much fun. People out there, like, seriously, we writers, we really do actually have a lot of fun in between all the agony.
Yeah, in between the agonies.
Yeah, in between.
The little agonies. Yeah. So there's a whole scene where they're running through the downtown in the middle of the night, and we see it, we witness it, and we feel it and all that. And then, like, it cuts to, like, a television report the next day of the news with some cell phone footage of this happening. Mm-hmm. And rather than saying, oh, my God, there are naked mutants running through downtown with goat hoofs, they say, a bunch of parkour enthusiasts were trying to raise attention about the homeless problem, dressed up in costumes. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. That makes much more
Except
sense.
Except the boy who was working on the computer and turns around and starts watching it, and he's like, I think I know that guy. So I'm waiting for him to show up in the next book, too.
Oh, that would be Jake. Jake is a reporter for The Stranger. So we have so many Seattle references in here, and Matt really enjoys getting the visuals right. So he, like, you know, we have, you'll see Volunteer Park, you'll see Seward Park, you'll see the Waterfront Park, you'll see everything.
By the way, you mentioned the I-5 corridor, and they call it the jungle there, you know, what's the other word for it, the actual technical term? It's the, you know, it's like you have it anywhere, you have freeways where you have greenery in between the freeways. What's that called?
Oh, yeah, median. Those, like, the medians?
Well, I don't know. Anyways, it'll come to me later. But one of the photos, because one of the things is you have Pigeon Hill, or if you come up on the other side of the Duwamish, the big hill that's where West Seattle starts, there's also a lot of people up there. And I thought one of your visuals actually looked like it was there where he gets beat up, or the boy is going to beat him up with the baseball bat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did I nail that right?
Yeah, yeah, that's it. That's it.
Yay!
I mean, the jungle is pretty much from the International District on Dearborn, south all the way to Georgetown.
Yeah.
And there's a whole area at that point, because Beacon Hill is on the eastern flank.
Yeah.
I-5 is sort of wedged against the hill and creates sort of a natural lean-to, or an artificial lean-to.
Mm-hmm. The west, you've got, over the Duwamish, you've got the big hillside that's still all green. There's all that word is on the tip of my tongue. Greenbelt.
There you go.
Ha-ha.
Right, and so, you know, and by the way, the conditions are horrible under there. For anybody to say, oh, you guys should just go ahead and live underneath the freeway, it's, at least you'll stay dry.
You're being poisoned.
I've been under there. It's deafening. I mean, it's so loud under there. If you had to live like that, I can't even imagine. It's so loud.
Well, and it's actually expanding. I was in, I don't know, it's. When I moved here from California, my big city of reference was San Francisco. San Francisco was worse at that point than Seattle is right now, but just barely, people. You have caught up with the hideousness of San Francisco, FYI. And I moved up here. I came up to visit. My husband had gotten a job, and I came up to visit in September of 1997, right before I got pregnant with my son, who was born the next year. And my experience of walking through Seattle in 1997 in September was to constantly say to my husband, I am so amazed. And he'd be like, what? And I'm like, well, boyfriend at the time. I said, there's no homeless people anywhere. It doesn't smell bad. There's no one under that bridge over there. Oh my gosh, we just drove under a bridge and there's not people camped out under it. That was what I was saying in 97. And I felt like Seattle had done it right. They had prevented the horrors that were taking over, you know, San Francisco. And when we moved up here, I was just like, this is so awesome. They're not screwing up. They're going to do it better. I don't feel that way anymore. And I'm really deeply personally wounded and disappointed. I know people who have been homeless in Seattle. It's very personal to me. And just the other day, I was walking through Lincoln Park, and we've got people now who are living in Lincoln Park. So really, I'm sitting around waiting. I'm just looking at everyone. And I'm like, when are you going to actually decide this needs to be resolved? Because once we make the decision, we decided to go to the moon, we got to the moon. We want to go to Mars, we got to Mars. If we decided to solve the issue, I believe we could. So the fact that it hasn't been solved, to me, says we're just basically not dealing with it.
Right, right. And that's what the Cloven is about.
Yeah.
The Cloven is about, I mean, all these topics, right? The homelessness. What is homelessness coming from? It's coming from income disparity.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming from the fact that there are, you know, 2,100 or three, however many now are living in the jungle, like living in tents because they can't afford housing in Seattle. And over here across the water, you can go across, drive across a floating bridge and get to a house that is worth some $66 million, some people say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that just seems somehow wrong. I don't know.
I think there's actually well over 11,000 homeless people in Seattle. Not greater Seattle, but Seattle.
Yeah.
So, and there's the jungle, but then there's all the tent cities. And it's like I look at what's going on and I feel like it reminds me of what's a Scrooge. I'm sorry, I feel like America is becoming the Britain that we tried to get away from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the reason they shipped off their prisoners to Australia was because they had overcrowded prisons, because they locked up all the people who were poor because of the system that they had created. Well, hello, we have more people in prison per capita than I think any other country in the world. You know, I mean, there's big issues, and so it's sort
and
of.
And why cool. do you think there's a why do you think there's such a big push right now to get to Mars?
Distraction.
I don't know. Maybe it's the new Australia. I'm just saying.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm just sitting here thinking, if you can't survive on this planet, which literally makes life so easy, why are we trying to go out to these other environments that are so impossible and have this illusion, this weird idea that our salvation will come through being able to survive in those inhospitable environments? If we can't do it here, what makes us think we're going to do it there? I don't know. Anyways,
Exactly.
so yeah, but all of this is coming up through this really cool graphic novel. Ah!
Hopefully, I mean, that's the idea, is that we're dealing with topics that are worth talking about in a way that's entertaining and provocative. We're definitely trying to be provocative. There's no question that we want people who read our book to discuss it, to think about it,
Yeah.
and to wonder about it, and to call up a friend about it and say, do you really think that we could? And, you know, by the way, I don't know if you guys know this. You know, when we first invented the cloven, it was all kind of like pipe dream stuff. Since then, CRISPR, the method for snipping out different aspects of one's DNA
Which,
and
by the
replacing
way,
it.
I've only heard the word. I literally have not looked into it. So there
Oh
may
my
be,
God.
I don't know anything about it.
CRISPR is an acronym for something. I don't even know what it stands for, but it does stand for, each letter stands for something. But essentially, it's a method for using, ironically, it's a very similar method. Now, let's not conflate the whole concepts, but it's a similar method than what's being used with the mRNA vaccines for COVID, which is the idea of you go in to DNA and you try and take out the offending code and replace it with code that isn't offending.
Sure,
And they're
people have
called
been gene therapy.
gene therapy, right?
Sure.
So in doing it in there's one thing if you do it like when they're doing it as a COVID vaccine, you're theoretically not altering the actual DNA. You're just altering cell DNA. There's a difference between germline DNA and other. So what we're talking about with CRISPR is altering the gene line so that a change would become a permanent change for one's heirs.
And I was going to say they want to do that actually to, I guess, the egg, or is it after it's
It
fertilized?
can
But
be
they're.
done, it can actually be done to either. And in fact, you know what they can do now? This is going to be really surprising. They can use a skin cell from you, and they can make an egg that you don't have. And
Really?
then they can use that same skin cell, and they can make some sperm that you don't have. And then they can inseminate that egg with, fertilize that egg with that sperm cell, and they can make grow cells. So theoretically, life is being formed from one parent.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've long believed that there is this phenomenal relationship between what occurs in the world of science and technology and everything else. It could even be like, why did anyone ever sail around the world? They sailed around the world because prior to doing it, someone dreamed it up and imagined it. So when you look back at the science fiction, right, or you look at Frankenstein, right? I mean, Frankenstein, you know, that was written by Mary Shelley, right? Right. Well, she imagined something. And so often, or you look at George Orwell and you look at that guy who was the nephew of the father of psychoanalysis who wrote all those propaganda books. Name does not come to me right now, but there's this guy who like is the father of propaganda. Well, you know, you write those stories and then someone reads them. Well, then they might copy your idea or be motivated. People had to dream of going to space before we started to do it. So it's interesting that your story aligns with current modern day scientific advancements or exploration and whatnot, that there's actually a link there.
Well, I think that's what the role of if I may be so bold as to classify myself as an artist, I think that's the role of the artist in our society, is to reflect, you know, what he or she sees is going on in a way that may have some kind of different resonance, right? If you look at Frankenstein, by the way, which I think is one of the most fabulous books ever written, and Mary Shelley is a brilliant genius for having written it. But what was intriguing her at the time that she wrote it? I mean, it was done out of kind of a bet. They were all, she and her husband and all their poet friends were sitting around a table at somebody's grand manor and for a rainy weekend, and they said, "That's all. Each one of us is going to write a ghost story, and whoever is the best, we're going to like try and get published."
Oh,
and
okay.
Hers was the best. But you know what was going on at that time? Electricity was just
coming into it.
And they realized, I can't remember the name of the doctor, but the scientist studied using electrical impulses and a frog's leg to make a frog's leg a dead frog's leg, right? So it's been removed from the frog, so it's just the leg, no frog, and they could plug in electrodes and make it move.
Yeah.
And so that animation from electricity was just being explored when Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein. So she was really at the cutting edge of technology of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're doing is the same. We're trying to push the cutting edge of the technology of CRISPR. You know, although it's illegal in many places, right now there are two young girls in China, two twins, mm-hmm. who were born just a couple of years ago, artificially inseminated, and they had their genes altered mm-hmm. By a scientist, and they are immune to HIV, theoretically.
Interesting.
We'll see.
Well, that means that that assumes that we know how the HIV virus invades the body.
That's right.
That they made the body impervious to that invasion?
Well, they went in and they said, okay, you know, these chromosomes are responsible. These if you have a defect in this chromosome, you are susceptible to getting HIV.
Oh.
So if we go in and clip that out and put in a regular chromosome that is mm-hmm. not susceptible, then you'll be okay. And so that's what they did. And they mm-hmm. brought these embryos to fruition. These girls really exist. They're really alive. They
sure.
were born. They used a surrogate. And as soon as they were born, the scientist was arrested and put in jail because you can't do that.
Oh, well, and I hope they're not considered property. I hope they're not, like, owned, obviously. That's what we're always scared of, right?
Is it news.
Well, right, but we're always scared that the lab will then own the child and the child will not be a free human but will be viewed. Yeah. So, right, this is the fodder of stories because it is the reality of what human beings can sometimes do. We look back on human history. We realize no law actually works 100% of the time, and that all sorts of people out there who are excited by what they can possibly accomplish are willing to do all sorts of weird, creepy things sometimes in pursuit of that. I mean, if you think about it, though, sickle cell anemia, great example, passed down genetically. People choose not to have children because they're terrified they're going to curse their children with this horrible disease. I am sure it's a completely laudable idea if we could go in and say to this person, we're going to take that gene risk out of your sperm or your whatever, and we're going
to,
you know. So we all get the potential beautiful value of it. And it's the human story goes on.
Just to take that example for one second on a little sidebar, a little detour here.
Yes.
Sickle cell anemia in particular, which is fatal nearly all the time, right? It's like a horrible disease. It really is bad.
You suffer and then you die.
Why do people get sickle cell anemia? Well, it turns out that you don't that there's a gene in one parent that if you get the altered gene, the sickle cell gene
mm-hmm.
from one parent, you don't get sickle cell anemia.
You're a carrier
disease.
Then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you get it from both parents, that's when you get sickle cell disease.
Right.
Now, if you get it only from one parent, you know what you get?
What?
Immunity from malaria.
Really?
Really. And that's why almost everybody who has sickle cell comes out of a certain area of Northern Africa and, you know, wherever else it is. You can see there's a map on the internet you can find that shows a yellow bubble over where most of the cases are reported.
Yeah.
And those are reported in places that are very high in malarial deaths because there's a lot of mosquitoes who carry malaria. So it's unfortunate that if you get two of those genes, you're in big trouble. If you get zero of those genes, you're probably going to die of malaria. But if you get one of them, you're immune. And so if you take away the sickle cell gene, and say, you're not going to die of sickle cell anemia because we're going to get rid of that in anybody's gene, you're also going to lose a lot more people to malaria. The reason this takes place always, almost always, is because of the ego.
Yeah.
It's because because of our hubris, because we think that we can, because we think that we should, because we think that we have the right to control everything and to change everything, not understanding the web of interwoven destinies of all things on in the universe should not be altered because you don't want, you know, a certain, you want blue eyes instead of brown eyes. You know, that just, it's not justifiable. And I will say that oftentimes writers can fall into the exact same trap. Obviously, the stakes aren't as high. But what happens, I find, when writers are working on books is that they get, and E.M. Forster wrote about this, by the way, it's not, I didn't invent this idea.
Mm-hmm.
He said that, you know, you should take a book away from a writer when they're two-thirds of the way through. Because after that, they're just trying to get to the end. And so they make things happen. So generally what happens in a story is that it's going great, and then the author wants something to happen and so forces the characters to do something against their will or against their nature, and then it becomes contrived because that never would have happened if these characters were substantial people.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. You can definitely read the books where you see that happen, or, you know, suddenly the crocodile jumps out of the freezer in Alaska and kills the bad guy because you just had to kill the bad guy somehow.
Right, exactly.
Right, yeah, exactly. No. Oh my goodness. Garth, as always, having a conversation with you is just like one of the best ways to spend my time.
It's been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed it. It went by quickly, didn't it?
It did. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And I would like to make sure that people know your website, because you said there's a bunch of cool stuff on the website related, actually, to the graphic novel.
Yes, I have my website, garthstein.com. Mm-hmm. You can link to the Cloven-specific site from there, or you can go directly to theclovenproject.com. And that's sort of a parallel site of content. There's a whole bunch of news stories up there, and you can go there and try and figure out which ones are true and which ones are out of Garth's head.
Oh, that's so much fun. Oh my gosh, I bet I'll get it wrong half the time.
Yeah, I don't know. Some of them are pretty crazy. It's true. And some of the stuff that I can come up with is I can slide things in. There definitely is an article about Vashon Island on theclovenproject.com.
Okay, so they're all .com. So we have garthstein.com, and we have theclovenproject.com.
Yep.
And everyone on this island can go play, have fun. And thank you very much for caring enough about our local community, the people who are suffering in Seattle, and for bringing so many of them to our awareness.
The pleasure is all mine, trust me. And I hope that people enjoy the book and are ready for volume 2 when it comes out.
Yes, absolutely. Garth, thanks for coming on the show.